Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Alan Sloan, business journalist and columnist for The Washington Post, joins me to discuss Trump's effect on the debt and deficit, the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, and we get into some differences on economic theory.
And Heather Digby Parton will join us to discuss the end of the Trump presidency and the beginning of the Biden administration. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at rofpodcast.com. It's your support that keeps this show going. Don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/themajorityreport. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, this is our first program in 4 years that we are doing without Donald Trump being the president of the United States. And how does it feel?
Well, I mean, obviously that part of it, I feel great and relieved and happy, but it's a very strange thing. I mean, you know, I suppose we can get into the psychology of it, which is odd when you've had he has dominated our political culture so overwhelmingly for so long that it's a strange feeling to have him be suddenly irrelevant. And of course, he may not remain irrelevant. There's a lot out there that could change all that, and he could be, you know, still be a major part of the Republican coalition, whatever, going forward. But on right now, it doesn't feel like he matters. And that is a very, very weird and, you know, positive yet surreal kind of feeling after the last 4 years that we've been through. Five, really, because we were covering him through the primaries as well. It's a long time, you know, half a decade we've been obsessing over this guy. Not because we wanted to, but we just had no choice. He was just such a dominating presence in our political life. So it's an odd day, hopeful, and, you know, maybe we can start to, do some real policy again, which would be kind of a unique, you know, sort of thing after all this time. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. How about you? I mean, how are you feeling?
I share all those sentiments. And the thing is, it ended too with just an enormous amount of intensity. I mean, the past really, you know, the past 2 months. Particularly leading up to the election, but since the election, you know, there's been that quality of like, oh, I woke up at 2 a.m. I better check Twitter to see if, somebody's overrun the Michigan State House or something to that effect. And particularly, you know, with happened on January 6th, I mean, it just, heightened the tension of an already sort of like tense 4 years. But I was saying on the Majority Report the day after that, you know, there's that quality of like, that I get before vacation where like I'm just pushing through, and then vacation hits and I immediately get a cold. Or something to that effect, or I'm exhausted, you know, like the day after vacation starts because it all is catching up. And I think in many respects, you know, 400,000 people are dead. 4,000 people, more than 4,000 people died on inauguration day of COVID. The enormous intensity of, you know, living life in a pandemic that was layered on top of the intensity of Donald Trump. And, you know, our experience in the, you know, covering this stuff is obviously narrow, and I don't want to get too myopic, but it felt like for 4 years that, and it's as if I had been a runner for 15 years, But for four of those, really, instead of like running like I would run a marathon, I was running like I was in a full out sprint. I mean, the pace of everything was so dramatic. And the nature of the political news under Trump was not in any way technocratic, really.
Right.
I mean, it was a very distinct sort of almost, you know, like a TV show. And, you know, and I don't mean just like a TV show in that it's supposed to be entertaining or whatnot, but like just sort of broad plot twists that really, you know, vaguely resemble reality. But and the fact is, these broad plot twists very often led to the immiseration of people, and generally those people who have the least political power in our society. And there's still a lot of suspense in terms of like what Joe Biden's going to do. And I know we're going to talk about this and how the media is going to react. Are they going to remember who it was that basically was carrying Donald Trump on their shoulders for 4 years? You know, Donald Trump could not have done this on his own. He could have been very, very isolated if the Republican Party was a different entity than it is. So I have a lot of these mixed emotions. And then also, you know, you and I had been talking about for months the idea that Joe Biden is not going to a Joe Biden win and ascension to the presidency and an inauguration is going to be very different than when Barack Obama was elected. And, you know, both because we as a people have changed and because Joe Biden is not the sort of or does not was not a wasn't even running as a transformative figure. There's a very different dynamic that I think is fascinating, frankly. And because, you know, I was doing the same thing 13 years ago when Barack Obama came into office and as you were doing the same thing, you know, this is we've completed a circle of sorts. And it is interesting to be able to compare with that type of firsthand knowledge. You know, like I found myself citing Gore Vidal, who we interviewed many times in the original Majority Report, but he came in once and I remember sitting across from him and he was talking about the United States of amnesia. And he was saying like, you know, we in this country, we don't remember anything. We don't remember anything from, you know, like from what happened just a couple of years ago in terms of politics. And I was sort of looking at him and I didn't really fully understand what he was talking about. And on some level, I sort of understand that now. I'm just thinking of a clip I saw of Jim Sciutto, or I don't know what his name is, on CNN, sitting up on the parade route for the inauguration and yelling down, "Are you going to unify the country, Joe Biden?" And it's just like, what? Are you serious? Come on.
Well, I saw that, and I actually tweeted it out. I'm going, and it was just like that. Are you kidding me? I mean, first of all, it was literally 2 weeks since a marauding band of insurrectionists just went and took over the U.S. Capitol to try and overturn the election. I mean, it's like, this is a joke, right? Are we all just, are you going to unify, how are you going to unify the country or whatever? I'm thinking, what world are we living in? And I think you're absolutely, you know, that quote from Gore Vidal is absolutely correct. And I even feel it on the day after the inauguration, just as we said, 2 weeks from the day that there was a violent insurrection in the nation's capital, that suddenly, you know, we turn the page and everybody's kind of going, okay, you know, that was really something. That was, you know, gee, that Donald Trump, what a card. And now we're moving on. The Republicans are right back to what they were always about, pretending as if Donald Trump didn't exist. And now they're getting angry and defensive and playing this troll game of how dare Joe Biden say he's unifying the country when he's calling out white supremacists and racists and insulting half the country. And it's like, do you know what you're saying there?
Right.
I mean, you're basically taking ownership of the white, you know, why do you think he's talking about you?
Right.
And yet, you know, what makes you say that this is insulting you? And that's the kind of thing, and it twists people in knots, you know. I mean, it's this, I know you are, but what am I kind of of political theater that the right wing puts on. And there's nothing new about it. I wrote about it months ago, anticipating this, and just going, everybody get ready because we're going to reset.
Yeah.
On the day of the election, on the day of the inauguration, and suddenly it's a whole new world. And in some respects, that can be great, right? You want to reset, and like for the pandemic, good for Joe Biden. They're going in there. They're going to redo the whole thing and try and fix this, what they are claiming and saying now was no plan at all. You know,
yeah.
They came in and went, okay, where's the plan we've been waiting for and you've been holding back? And they're kind of, well, we never really had one. So that's a good thing. That's the reset that you're looking for. But on the other hand, this idea that suddenly we're just going to forget what not only happened 2 weeks before, but what happened 4 years before and what the Republicans actually did. And I'm not going to blame Donald Trump anymore. I'm not. You know, I don't feel, I mean, he is what he is. We all know what he is. I am blaming his collaborators. And they were all there. They were all doing it. And we're just, you know, the intense sort of fear that I have at the moment. And I, you know, like you, I'm sitting here, you know, feeling mixed emotions. But the negative side of it is that I am absolutely intensely afraid that they are going to just, you know, they're going to turn the page. And not because, I don't think Biden's going to come out and say what Obama said, you know, which we're not going to look backwards, we need to look forwards. I hope he doesn't actually say that. But that doesn't mean there isn't just this, it's kind of an undertow. It's not even something people may be consciously feeling that they're going to do. But I noticed it when I'm watching Nancy Pelosi. She's talking about the impeachment trial and when she's going to send it over. And we're watching the machinations in the Senate and people negotiating and all that. And I got this. I thought, oh, my God, this is the day after the inauguration. And, you know, it's like it's going to be within a month like it never happened. And that is a terrible thing because what happened, what you described as this television show, which it was, but it was a horror movie, and it was a preview of something much, much worse that can happen in the future if someone comes along. And, you know, I mean, it was very, very close. It was, the election was close. It was, you know, we were close to having a real insurrection. We, you know, it wouldn't have taken that much to see the whole thing explode if those Republicans out in the country had followed the lead and actually, you know, people like in Georgia had overturned the election or sent different electors to the Congress. We could have been in real trouble, serious, serious trouble. And the idea of just sweeping that under the rug because, and it's not because anybody wants to do it necessarily, it's because of this phenomenon that Gore Vidal was talking about America. And it's that we just don't remember anything.
It's fascinating. I mean, and there's like a two-step, right? I mean, part of it is this sort of, I think, fear by Democrats on some level to be seen as not being a unifiers or something like that. And it is also, I think the fear is from the media. You know, we've already seen, like I was talking about this earlier this week, that, you know, someone had done an expose from the Washington Post that Scranton Joe has a Peloton, which is a fairly expensive. I mean, it's not like a $10,000. It's a consumer, you know, bicycle, bike training thing, whatever you call it. Indoor biking thing that, you know, even people in Scranton probably own those.
My next door neighbor has one.
Well,
he's not rich.
And I mean, that's the thing, is that it's like that is this really going to be a problem for Joe Biden that he has a Peloton? I mean, honestly, that is just absurd. There is this sort of, I don't know what it is. There is this just intense desire to write these type of stories. And on some level, part of it is a function of the Democrats shying away from this conflict and from the reality that we have a very split country. I mean, the amnesia thing, you know, over the past year or two, maybe more, I have gotten very, very interested in Reconstruction. And I don't know, once a month I've done an interview, it feels like, on a a massacre that took place during Reconstruction, where black people were massacred because they had gained political power. And that is the way that Reconstruction was thrown asunder. Ultimately, it was by violence. And violence on the floor of the Senate, violence in Wilmington, in Mississippi, in North Carolina, in South Carolina. I mean, this is and what was amazing about it is that there was no, that it seemed to be just getting swallowed up by history. All of Reconstruction was practically swallowed up by history, and these are. You know, Reconstruction, we talk about the founding of the country. That was like a founding of the country that was in many respects aborted. It was snuffed out because of white supremacy. I mean, the nature of the country would be so different today if what existed in, you know, the early 1870s in South Carolina, North Carolina, in Mississippi, you know, in some of these southern states. And we don't know about it. And so, you know, the idea that like something as not inconsequential, but not as consequential as Reconstruction gets lost in this sort of American sort of desire to like, you know, it's just a deep, deep denial. Now, with that said, Nancy Pelosi today said she is going to follow the evidence. She does not believe it's unifying to neglect what Donald Trump did in terms of the January 6th insurrection. But I hope this extends to the Republican Party and not just a couple of bad apples as we pivot, both in real time and in terms of our discussion, to Mitch McConnell, again, on day one, holding the Senate hostage to get an ironclad commitment from Chuck Schumer that Chuck Schumer will not get rid of the filibuster. In other words, McConnell's filibustering the ability of the Senate to go forward and provide and allow for appointment of Joe Biden's cabinet because he won't allow the rules, votes on the rules to change. And right now, technically, Republicans, you know, sort of run the place because there hasn't been a new vote on restructuring the Senate. And so we may have to see, Chuck Schumer do filibuster reform right now as a way of being able to do filibuster reform later. I mean, or just to get the things going. But this is the movie starts all over again.
It's well, you and I both are unsurprised by this, I think. I mean, this is a very, very provocative move on the part of Mitch McConnell. But, you know, this is a guy who just seated a Supreme Court justice, you know, 6 weeks before an election, after having refused to seat one 8 months before an election, having no problem making completely, you know, opposite arguments each time. This is what he does. He's actually very effective as an opposition leader, probably more effective as an opposition leader, just in terms of doing what he really wants to do, which is obstruct the other side.
It's also because, you know, what is the actual proactive agenda of the Republican Party after tax cuts?
After tax cuts, you're done. Their reason for being now at this point is to stop anything from happening and maintain power. And Mitch is doing what he can here to maintain power. My question in this, I mean, this is something that, you know, keeps coming up. Like, you know, what do these people really want? What do they want? What are they looking for? And I don't at this point think that they want anything other than just power for the sake of power and rolling back whatever progress that has been made. I mean, this is really what they're about. So when you're looking at what Mitch is trying to do here, I shouldn't call him Mitch, it's too familiar, McConnell is trying to do here, he is trying to maintain the power that he wants, but he's also using this as some form of negotiation to keep the filibuster. But I think it may also have something to do, and I could be wrong here, but I think it may have something to do with this impeachment thing. I think he has decided that this impeachment trial may be a bad idea. And even though he's out there saying, I think he provoked it and he did this, I think he may be thinking that maybe we want to just let Donald Trump fade into the woodwork, and bringing him back up in this kind of a high-profile thing may be a bad idea. My thought was, when I first saw all this going on, was that maybe Mitch McConnell is trying to use this, you know, filibustering the natural order. Yes, he would like to get that agreement, but also he would like to have that impeachment trial abandoned. And you know, I don't know what will happen there, but he wants something out of this. And there's just no way that he's going to be able to hold up the U.S., the Senate. If Schumer, you know, digs his heels in and says, Absolutely not, we're not going to give up our right to abolish the filibuster. You can't tell us that. You know, that's ridiculous, considering what McConnell has just done over the past 4 years, including what I just said, you know, that he came out and said 6 weeks before the election, the party in the majority gets to do what it wants to do, and, you know, they can say that the Democrats don't have a majority, but they do, because Kamala Harris makes up that majority as the vice president. So, you know, this is just the beginning. It's the opening salvo. It's him, you know, exerting his power within his own caucus, and I think they like that. I think that he was getting a little – they were feeling like maybe
– well, he's playing
– getting a little wobbly, and I think that he is now – coming out swinging, and that helps him personally maintain his power within the caucus as well.
He's playing with House money, right? I mean, he's playing with House money, and he has won, you know, in the annals of the Senate. He's going to go down as being perhaps one of the most significant Senate majority leaders we have, only because those 240 some odd justices he placed on the federal courts, including the Supreme three on the Supreme Court, they're going to be around a lot longer than any of the people we're talking about. And they are going to dictate what the political reality is for my children. And so now he's playing with House money. And I think what he's doing, I think you're right. I think this probably does have a lot to do with impeachment. I think for a while, Mitch McConnell thought the best way for us to get past Donald Trump is to have an impeachment, distance ourselves, show the world that we're apart from Donald Trump. And then I think what happened was, frankly, is that he saw what happened to those 10 or 11 Republicans in the House that voted for impeachment. And I think he realized, like, ooh, this is a little worse than I thought it was with the Republican Party. Or at least now I have a clear sense of, and the best thing for us to do is just to pretend none of this ever happened and just don't say a word, because going into 2022, there are half a dozen Republican Senate seats that are very vulnerable, a function of retirement and a function of, like, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. And I think Toomey is resigning, and there are may resign. There are a couple other seats, Rubio, even perhaps possibly. There are a couple other seats that are going to be, you know, maybe a problem for Republicans. And, you know, I'm looking at this thing right now, sort of consistent with the unity theme, right? The broad unity thing, as opposed to the bipartisanship that I think Biden is pursuing. And we should talk about that. There's a story in the Washington Post on Thursday entitled "Which Republicans Are Most Likely to Think the Election Was Stolen?" And the title is "Those Who Dislike Democrats and Don't Mind White Nationalists." Now, on some level, that's burying the lead, as far as I'm concerned, because what was stunning about this is they asked three questions of about 2,600 registered voters, all Republican, including, I guess it was 962 Republican and Republican leaners. And over 70% of the Republicans said they agreed with President Trump's contention that he received more votes than Joe Biden. 70% believe that Donald Trump won more votes than Joe Biden. Now, if you go down, they have there's three statements. They said millions of fraudulent mail and absentee ballots were cast. Voting machines were manipulated to add tens of thousands of votes to Joe Biden. And lastly, thousands of votes were recorded for dead people. More than 50% of Republican respondents said those three statements were very accurate. That is 75% of Republicans said each one was either very accurate or somewhat accurate. The Republican Party is looking at a potential for a massive fissure. And it's not going to break in half, but like there's a couple of people who still have to appeal in the Republican Party to normal human beings. And it is really going to be up to Chuck Schumer and to Nancy Pelosi, but really more Chuck Schumer and to Joe Biden to find the places where those cracks are and drive a wedge in there as hard as he can. Impeachment, I think, is one of those things. I think there's probably the vast majority of Republicans are going to vote against impeachment. But I think there's a couple that would rather not take that vote.
Yep.
And I think finding those things is going to be crucial going forward. It appears now Joe Biden has gone to, you know, has been in negotiations, even in his transition, with like people like Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski and a gang of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And Romney and Murkowski already said, I think it was, Thursday or the day after inauguration, like it's a little bit soon to go back and get more COVID relief. The ink on the last bill is not dry. Joe Biden has to immediately find some bill that he can put in there that is going to break apart Republicans. And if he, the idea of like checks and shots have been floated. And then he has to abandon this notion that he's ever going to strike a deal with Republicans, because it's not happening. And they can perform all this kabuki that they want, but the bottom line is the longer he stays in the game of trying to get unity, the more he is going to be held responsible for not getting it. They
right.
should use the dissension that exists right now and the understanding that the country has, that the country is fractured, while it's still vaguely fresh in their mind that, you know, a bunch of these Republican senators basically promoted an insurrection. He should use that to pursue his political agenda, because he's not going to get there's not going to be a better opportunity. People aren't going to say 6 months from now, boy, I guess the Republicans, that's just not the way it happens. And I think he's got literally like 3 or 4 weeks before everybody forgets that, wait a second, are the Republicans really that polarizing? I mean, it's just the nature of our politics, and he has got to do this now, it seems to me. And Schumer has got to do this now, because they only get weaker. They're only in a weaker position later. This whole story they're telling themselves, well, if the Republicans reject something, then we'll have a predicate for this. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? That's like, I don't know. It's like, this serial killer killed 12 people, but they stopped killing everybody a year ago. Let's wait for them to kill again so we can go have an excuse to arrest them. I don't think so.
No, and the thing, you're absolutely right about this. The thing is, it is fresh in everyone's mind right now what they did, what they are. I mean, it's as fresh as we can get, right? We were just talking about the amnesia and the day after and all of that stuff. You can already see the vision of it fading and getting less and less vivid. And it was only 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
I mean, this is amazing. So that you have to strike while the iron is hot. And he has another argument to make, is that this is incredibly urgent. I mean, we're talking this pandemic stuff and the economic, but there were 900,000 new unemployment claims
yep.
this week.
Yep.
I mean, this is. That is worse than the Great Recession.
By far.
We're now what 11 months into the pandemic, and this is happening. This is as urgent as it gets. The idea of Mitt Romney walking around, well, I don't know. It just seems like we just gave him a bunch of money. You know, that kind of. Are you joking? I mean, this is completely, unbelievable. And I did think that there had been energy toward that. on both with Republicans as well. I had been under the impression that there was an understanding that this was, you know, this was really, really serious, and they had to do it right away. So the fact that Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski are hemming and hawing, that just tells you where, you know, if that's going to be our, you know, moderate caucus that we're all going to gather around, and they're going to actually get things done. They're the problem solvers. Isn't that what they're calling themselves in
yep.
the House? I mean, no, they're not ready to solve any problems if they can't see that right now, with 900,000 new unemployment claims and 400,000 people dead and dying by the tens of thousands, and we can't get vaccines, and we have the vaccines and we can't get them in people's arms. If they don't see that as being urgent, then I think that they are irrelevant. And I hope that Joe Biden, you know, understands this. And I'm not, you know, I mean, we should talk a little bit about him and what he seems to be doing. And I'm finding it it's a little different than I expected. Let me just put it that way.
Well, let's start with what you expected.
I think I expected him to be, I expected him to be more overtly kind of, bipartisan, by which I mean that I thought we were going to hear more about his Republican buddies and how they were going to work things out. I thought once he got in that this was going to make a big trip up to the Hill and he and Mitch would be taking pictures to get, you know, I mean, I sort of assumed that he would at least make that gesture. Now, he may be doing that, and from what we understand, he is talking to these people behind the scenes, and maybe he's trying to do this, you know, do bipartisanship kind of on the QT. That's a big problem. If he makes deals as he's made in the past during the Obama administration, we've got a big problem. On the other hand, you know, he came in, you know, did some big stuff with executive orders, which is not a Joe Biden kind of thing to do, because he's a legislator by nature, right? I mean, he came in and just did 17 on day one, and they were major. They were making a statement, and it was very offensive to Tucker Carlson, which means, in my view, that means it must be good. That's an easy sort of way for me to judge whether anything is good, is whether or not Tucker Carlson hates it. So they did some things that surprised me, like firing a couple of the people that
fired the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, fired the head of the Voice of America, or the parent company for the Voice of America. And one more escapes me at the moment.
Yeah.
But it was
it was bold,
significant,
you know,
fire.
And it's controversial.
Oh, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
You can't do that. You know,
the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau chief, and put in an incredibly strong. He just came off the FTC. He was a Elizabeth Warren acolyte, and as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, so, you know, labor and bank regulation. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and these are, and you know, and those are really kind of, I mean, those are the kinds of things that are going to play into the bigger agenda, right? I mean,
yep.
Beyond just the urgent problems and crisis that we're facing in terms of unemployment and the pandemic, this goes to the bigger agenda. That has me feeling hopeful. But whether or not they can bring this off tactically, particularly in this, as you point out rightly, I think that he's got maybe a month. And that's maybe being generous, actually. I mean, it could be less than that, to absolutely frame this thing as, you know, an urgent problem that has to be done, and there has to be accountability, and he's not going to play any games. I mean, I think that's really what we're talking about here, is that he's going to take control and say, look, we're not going to go back and do this kind of stuff right now. If we have the power, we're going to use it, whether it's legislatively or whether, you know, through reconciliation, and he guides through some major, you know, legislation right away through reconciliation if he has to, or doing the kind of executive orders and you know, straightening out the executive branch. You know, they have to do a full audit and, you know, complete fumigation, as far as I'm concerned, to try and figure out, you know, how to make that work again. It's a big job, and I'm still not quite sure where he's going to go. I mean, he's a little bit more bolder than I expected. And I think, you know, it's funny because I wrote a piece for Salon about this, you know, kind of doing a, you know, sweeping out the old guard and what brings in the new guard. And we talked about Obama being we all thought he was going to be a transformational president, and he really wasn't. I mean, he was transformational in a sort of symbolic way, but not in a you know, more substantive way. And in fact, sort of continued many of the bad, you know, kind of democratic impulses that had been going on for the previous 30 years. And what I read this thing by Finan O'Toole, you know, the Irish essayist. He writes for The Guardian and the Irish Times. He's a very eloquent kind of fellow when you hear him speak. And he wrote a piece about Biden, looking at Biden's book. And in it, he said that, you know, Biden has the potential to be a different kind of transformational president, not because it's his personality necessarily, or even his ideological, you know, wherever he is. I think he's more like the kind of people that you talk about, your second favorite kind of politician.
Right, exactly. Ciphers.
Flow. you know, that's more like what he is. But because he's faced with a set of problems that are so huge and coming off of this trauma of Donald Trump and this era that we've just been through, and even going back, including his era in the Obama years and in the Bush years from the Iraq War and 9/11 and all of this, it's been so tumultuous that, you know, he, because of the sort of dark Irishness, as O'Toole calls it, he has this sort of within him, this feeling that you can transcend problems. And by transcendence, O'Toole puts it, it's not about restoration. It's more about, you know, it's about transcending some of the big problems that were in America and resetting us in a new place. Instead of trying to go back to the old place or, quote, make America great again or any of that, that Biden might be in a position to do something really substantial. And, you know, I noticed in the Oval Office, when they redid it and he goes in for the first time, he has Roosevelt, gigantic portrait of Roosevelt facing the desk in the above the fireplace, I think, in the Oval Office. So, you know, I don't know. I am open-minded. It seems unlikely, considering all the roadblocks that we have within the Democratic Party and within with the opposition being what it is. But you never know. And it may just be, you know, they used to say about Roosevelt that he, you know, had a second-class intellect and a first-class temperament or whatever. Wasn't that what they said? Maybe that's kind of Joe Biden, a person in a position to make major change if he'll take the initiative to actually do it within the ruins of, you know, a catastrophe and kind of rebuild. So, I don't want to be cynical about it. I really don't. I'm a little concerned about the rest of the Democratic Party, more than a little concerned, and I am desperately hoping that we don't let the Republicans just skate on what they've done and that lesson isn't learned, because, you know, these guys, I mean, they're the worst, right? They're the absolute worst. Anyway.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, and I would say, you know, I don't know, for me it breaks down like this. Like, we have the nature of the Democrats, the nature of American politics, to suggest that our country and our response to everything that's going on is not going to be up to the task. Not only the response to the crisis, but to the response of the sort of like underlying, slow-moving, grinding crisis that we have. If I want to be optimistic, and if folks want a little bit of optimism before we wrap things up in terms of Joe Biden, I would say the difference between, I think all the things you said about Joe Biden as a person are accurate. I think also the nature of what is going on in this country right now, it's a crisis. Some of it looks similar to the financial crisis, but I honestly believe that because the financial crisis, and it has knock-on effects, right? It has unemployment effects, it has foreclosure effects, et cetera, et cetera. But because the nature of the financial crisis was this response was dominated by bankers and financiers, right, who have a vested interest in, on a day-to-day basis, on the distribution of our resources in our society, specifically our money, and a vested interest in making sure that distribution is about maintaining wealth for specific individuals, right? As opposed to a public health crisis where the technicians who are responsible for addressing that, they're just basically like, we need resources for everybody. Like, they're oriented towards the idea of public health, right? It's not like, how can we get the top performing hospital in the country to be able to serve people? That's basically what Donald Trump did. I mean, frankly, right? I mean, he went in, he got his therapy and said, I want everybody to have this. And by everybody, he means, you know, if Giuliani gets it, or if Chris Christie gets it, or people who know me get it, or any Republican lawmakers get it, they'll get that type of treatment. But public health officials that presumably, you know, every day, Joe Biden, I imagine that he's going to get filled in by a public health official as opposed to a banker on this crisis. And their whole worldview is just going to be like, you got to throw resources. You got to use the government to go in there, use the Defense Production Act. I don't care what the profit margin Johnson & Johnson's going to get. If they need to produce the Pfizer vaccine, they produce the Pfizer vaccine. And I'm hoping, I mean, if people want optimism, I will not pretend that I have believed this 51%, but I'm offering it out there if people want some optimism.
We've been burned too often.
Yeah, yes, it's true. And that's why I wouldn't, if anybody's talking about like protesting or writing or whipping a count on the filibuster or whatever it is, I would not in any way not do that. But if people want optimism, maybe to tell their, you know, I don't know, their kids or their folks, or maybe just to get them to sleep at night, take 15 minutes. It would be that the nature of this crisis lends itself. There's just not as many people who are probably in Biden's ear who are talking about resolving this crisis, who have a vested interest in really targeting who gets saved here, right? I mean, it's a public health crisis. There is no cohort of people that are talking to Joe Biden that they don't want to help, because that's just the way that it works, right? This is a very, you know, a pandemic is a very good a metaphor for what it takes to have a functioning society, because it is intrinsically about our connection to other people. And that we are only as healthy as the sickest amongst us. And so maybe, you know, I mean, it's a question of whether Joe Biden can break out of his 50 years of training as a politician and get more aggressive, or at the very least that he has people around him who will. I mean, I don't know if Joe Biden came in and said, the first thing I want to do is fire the National Labor Relations Board General Counsel, because that guy is throttling the cases that gets to the board. But somebody who works for Joe Biden said that's one of the first things we should do. And he just said, OK.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And he did say, OK. You know, I mean, he didn't sit there and go, you know, well, I don't know. Do we really want to cause trouble? I mean, well, I don't know what he said, but in the end, he did it. So
yep.
That's really all that matters. And I felt like that was an important first sign, you know. It was one of those things. So she said, all right, you know, you're bold enough to do that, and knew it was going to cause controversy, and willing to do it. And, you know, I agree with you. This, you know, the pandemic and the way, and it's very interesting that you just said that about it sort of being a great metaphor for everything. I mean, if there's one thing that really takes collective action, it's dealing with this pandemic. And we have watched over the course of the last 11 months how our society sort of is, you know, broken down on its willingness to take collective action to protect ourselves, our families, and others, and whether or not we'll do what's necessary, even if we don't, you know, aren't personally, you know, at as much risk as others. Will we do what needs to be done to protect other people and to, you know, to help? And it's been a you know, I mean, I think we've seen something pretty ugly in a lot of ways on that. And we've seen it coming from our government. We saw it coming from our president, who saw the pandemic as nothing more than either an impediment or an opportunity for him personally getting reelected. And the way that the Republicans are still dealing with it. I mean, Mitt Romney, hero of, you know, of the Republic, standing up and go, I don't think we really need to, you know, send out any more money. I mean, that's absurd, right? And yet he's the guy who's doing that. So we've seen some things that have sort of, if nothing else, it is an illustration of the great polarization that we have in the reaction to the pandemic and how people have dealt with it. I mean, I had people here in Santa Monica where I live dancing in the mall, or actually it was in Century City, but close to me, dancing in the mall, singing YMCA and breathing in people's faces and doing that as a political act.
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
nuts.
There you have it.
Well, let's leave on that somewhat optimistic note. This could be the peak optimism during the Biden administration.
The
so let's leave it at that. Heather, congratulations on making it through the Donald Trump presidency. Pat on the shoulder, both our shoulders. And let's hope for better things. I know we're going to get better things, but let's hope for much better things, much better things under a Joe Biden administration. Certainly there's a lot of, you know, we could have talked about the DACA and what's happening with immigration reform. We will talk about that in the days to come.
Absolutely.
As always, a real pleasure, and we will talk again next week.
Okay, thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and, of course, the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Now let's hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host, Emma Vigeland.
Thanks, Sam. Hey, everyone. I am here with Alan Sloan, who is a business journalist and columnist at The Washington Post. How are you today, Alan?
I'm fine, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was fascinated by your piece because I think you laid it out so well. Alan wrote a very fascinating piece in both The Washington Post, and it was cross-published in ProPublica. Donald Trump built a national debt so big even before the pandemic that it will weigh down the economy for years. Now, I want to start first with the hypocrisy angle because, of course, the GOP, that's my favorite, right? Of course, the GOP constantly talks about debt and deficit, debt and deficit, debt and deficit. And then they're open about how they're going to bring it up, or they only bring it up, I guess, when there's a Democratic president. But the Tea Party was a movement predicated on reducing the national debt, reducing the deficit, and Trump ballooned it to these levels. I mean, you wrote about these figures in your piece. National debt rose by $7.8 trillion during his time in office. It's the third biggest deficit increase of any president, and the deficit outscored the Congressional Budget Office projections. I believe they thought 2018 and 2019 would be 2% and 3% of GDP, but both of those were over 4% of the GDP. Just a preview of what you wrote about. Can you talk about the disconnect there and just also lay out the ways Trump broke records on the debt and deficit in your piece?
Sure. Also, just so you'll know, I had a partner on this, a fellow named Cesare Potkel, whom I've worked with for a while in any number of places at ProPublica. What happened with Trump, whom I've written about for 30 years, and he hasn't changed any, except he's gotten a little heavier and he's now a former president. His great talent is telling people what they want to hear. So he goes on and he carries on in 2016, I guess it was, telling my Washington Post colleagues, I'm going to pay off the debt. You know, I'm from Brooklyn, so I'm allowed to talk this way because he's from Queens.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to pay off the debt in 8 years. Then, you know, he keeps talking about all the great progress he's making, and none of it is true because when you have a big tax cut the way they did, and they promised the tax cut would pay for itself and it would give average people a $4,000 a year increase in their salary. And of course, none of that happened. And meanwhile, Social Security, which by the way, I'm collecting, and Medicare, which I'm also collecting, is growing. The defense budget is growing. The revenues are down. And suddenly the Democrats are talking about they're worried about deficits. But I just wanted to look at all of these numbers and see what was going on. And Cesare and I worked on this together, and we were just shocked by what we found of how big it was and how many warnings there were, including warnings from Trump's own people before the virus set in, saying, we got to do something. And he never did anything, and then the whole thing blew up.
Well, I mean, you touched on some incredibly important points there. One, you being familiar with Trump's past work is key, because anybody who was familiar with his business dealings might understand that he wasn't exactly penny pinching or smart with his money. I mean, he's been bankrupt multiple times. So we can talk about his personal life and his personal business dealings and how maybe that informed this, even though I would say it's a broader Republican problem. I mean, they completely obfuscate and lie to the public about what their priorities are. They use the debt and deficit as a cudgel for Democrats when there's a Democratic president in office. And then both Bush and Trump ballooned the debt and deficit. But also, I mean, you talk about the tax cuts. People really do forget that Trump cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Can you talk about, one, Trump and your understandings about his relationship with money based on studying him for 30 years, and also the effect of the corporate tax rate on the debt and deficit?
Oh, okay. Now, I ran into Trump a long time ago, back when I was a newspaper reporter for something called New York Newsday of blessed memory, because it's gone out of business. Newsday hasn't, but New York Newsday is gone. And I'm the kind of person who actually reads numbers and reads financial statements, sort of understands them. And I'm looking at what this guy is talking about, and I'm looking at what the numbers say, and you sort of can't get from here to there. And he and I had a number of conversations, some of them obscene, which I can't repeat here, because, again, you know, he's from Queens and he has an accent. I'm from Brooklyn. I have an accent. And the longer he and I talk to each other, the heavier our accents got, because we're excited. We're waving our hands and we're doing all the things that you do. And, you know, I just couldn't stand him. And to the extent he knew about me, he couldn't stand me. So when the last thing on earth I expected was to see him as president. Also, I happen to live in New Jersey, where he ended up bankrupting. He had five bankruptcies in New Jersey. He had three casinos, all of which went bankrupt. And then the casinos became companies, and the companies went bankrupt. So he had five bankruptcies in New Jersey, one bankruptcy with a Plaza Hotel in New York, and a million, you know, foreclosures and forced sales. And he was, I think, a complete financial disaster. And then he ended up on television, and I think that's what made him. And that's what introduced him to, we'll call it, the rest of America, and made him look successful, and made him look like this, and made him look like that. And he really is good at telling an audience what interests an audience and what it wants to hear. That's his major talent. And then one day I wake up and he's president. I'm saying, how can this be? And the joke I wanted to do, but nobody laughed, was a corporate bankruptcy is called Chapter 11. So on Wall Street, if a company's going bankrupt, it's a 22, right? 2 times 11. So I wanted to call him Donald 66 Trump because he had six bankruptcies, but nobody thought that was funny. So I never got to do
it. Hey, no, I liked it. I liked it.
That's fine. But Emma, you weren't my editor, and it's too late now. He's gone.
Too late. Right. Well,
and now with the corporate tax thing, you know, the risk of making you angry, but then again, what can you do to me? The corporate tax rate of 35% was very high compared to the tax rates in other countries. So U.S. companies are doing all these weird things that I used to write about, of pretending to be, you know, a British company, pretending to be a Dutch, you know, going through all of these contortions. And the idea of cutting the rate from 35% to where I suspect the Biden people are going to try to put it, 28 or 29%, that would have been competitive. But instead, it went to 21. Now, this worked out great for me because my wife and I have been very lucky. We own a lot of stock relative to, you know, where we come from. and the stock went up. So we made a lot of money, but it was a terrible thing for the country. And it really left a big hole in the budget. And no one ever did anything about it. And by the way, the Democrats are about to start doing the opposite. The Republicans care. They say tax cuts pay for themselves. The Democrats are about to say public spending pays for itself. I mean, who knows? But Trump, you know, Biden didn't run promising to pay off the debt. Biden didn't run as a supposed financial genius. Biden never did what Trump did in October, for God's sakes. And he says, we're just about to start paying off the debt in a public meeting. He just makes it up and says it, and it isn't true. So Cesare and I went out and got the numbers, and we just wrote the numbers, and the numbers speak pretty powerfully, I think.
They do. It's one thing if you were going to cut the corporate tax rate and also fill in those loopholes that allow these companies to offshore and to circumvent a lot of the United States tax law. I mean, Amazon infamously has paid $0 in taxes, or, that's kind of the colloquial saying about it. So I think that's a more reasonable position. Trump was just trying to create some sort of economic sugar high in order to benefit himself, regardless of the long-term consequences to the economy. That's my read on things.
And I hate to say it, but that's also my read on things.
Okay.
We agree. Is that bad? That's probably bad.
No, it's a good thing. It's, I try to seek harmony and understanding. And I like talking to people who have expertise in certain issues, because it's not necessarily the things that I deal with on a day-to-day basis as a lefty and as a talk show host, basically co-host. But the other thing I want to touch on is the role of the debt and deficit. So you're pretty adamant that it's going to present a lot of problems. There are some MMT theorists out there that believe that it's less. So why laugh about MMT? I think that it's a hot button issue with a lot of people on the left, people who want to increase government spending. And I think you would agree in your piece, and as you did, that an injection of government funds into the economy right now is necessary. What's your perspective on that and how that relates to Trump and his handling of the debt and deficit?
All right. First of all, I can't help it. MMT, I wrote a column about that, I guess, about 2 years ago, enraging people. MMT stands for Modern Monetary Theory. And to summarize it, it means as long as you can borrow, you know, in a currency, as long as a country can borrow in a currency that it can print, the deficit doesn't make any difference. I called MMT the magic money theory, because money falls from the sky and it's wonderful and it's just great and there isn't any problem. And my problem, you know, I agree now, and I'm probably about to write a column saying, even though I'm no fan of Trump and I don't like debt very much, clearly we have to spend now to get the economy out of the rut. We have to. And that's how it is. But, you know, at some point we need to at least have some form of rationality. But MMT is wonderful. I used to call it, do you remember what the Laffer curve is?
Vaguely, yes.
That was this right-wing fantasy and created by a guy named Arthur Laffer, who I think Trump gave some medal to a few weeks ago or something, that basically tax cuts pay for themselves. So you can't, it's not possible to cut taxes too much, because the more you cut it, the more money you make. I mean, which is absurd, but it sounded good and had a lot of, you know, happy equations in it. I used to call MMT the lefty's Laffer curve, because I'm not a fan of anybody. I'm a congenital skeptic. I look at the numbers. I try to figure it out. I'm what I call a recovering English major. I majored in English at Brooklyn College. I became a business writer by accident. But I'm reasonably good with numbers, and I learned, and I talk to people, and I listen. So, you know, I have this sort of practical knowledge. I'm not real good at theory, but, you know, I'm pretty good at figuring stuff out. And, you know, the modern monetary theory just makes me laugh. The Laffer curve makes me laugh. Trump makes me laugh. I've got a weird sense of humor. Well, so, I mean, yeah. That's where I am.
So, but can you explain, like, what I think I take in terms of kernels from MMT, and not to get too off topic here, is just, I think the role of inflation in what is propagated by a lot of more establishment folks in the United States government is generally overblown, and a lot of times an excuse to hamper the Fed and push for more austerity measures. Would that be your assessment?
I'll shock you, because even though I'm not a lefty, I think, all right, the idea of inflation is a problem, or it can be, but you have to worry about it when you have it. You can't sit and run your life around inflation, especially when you, what you do is you start with your conclusions and work backwards to your assumptions, which is what a lot of political economics is. You have to invent a reason that you're afraid of inflation. So you say, gee, it's excessive spending. Tax cuts, of course, and deficits don't increase inflation. It's always spending. It's all just absurd. But again, since I'm not big on theory, I'm big on application. But at the end of the day, my numbers add up across and down. And, you know, I never did get a PhD in anything. So, you know, clearly I can't be informed.
Well, no. I mean, you've got a good New York, New Jersey sense of humor. I always appreciate that in a guest coming from the area myself. I saw you wrote another piece in the Washington Post that I wanted to touch on, because it does tie into the Trump administration's relationship with the economy. How divorced the markets were in 2020. I mean, they've been divorced for quite a while, I would say, from regular application of the economy to regular people's lives. But it really was obscene this year, the way that the Trump administration sort of semi-socialized the markets and injected a ton of money into them. And there was, in some instances, extremely profitable performance. While there was poverty and unemployment and mass hurt. Can you talk about that in relationship to the Trump administration?
Sure. I was one of the first people to actually pick up on this, because the difference between what was going on in the stock market and what was going on in the real world was just shocking to me. I mean, not shocking, outraged, because I try not to be outraged, but the difference was just astonishing. And again, it's not the Trump administration. A lot of it is the Federal Reserve, which is doing, I think, rightly what it thinks it needs to do, which is to compensate for the disastrous economic impacts of the COVID pandemic. I mean, you know, printing money doesn't save lives, but at least it helps the economy. And the Fed felt that since the rest of the government wasn't functioning really well to help, that they would hold down interest rates and do what they can do. But the Fed can help markets. It can help financial institutions. It can't send checks to individual people or support state and local governments, which I think should have been done. So you had this crazy thing where here's the Fed helping, doing what it can do, and that helped run the market up, which, again, made a lot of money by my standards for me. But I was looking at it and saying, well, I'm not giving the money back, but this is crazy, because people like me, or actually way above me on the food chain, are making out like mad. And the people who don't own a lot of stocks, which is most people, are not getting anything. I mean, and Trump, for whatever crazy reason, you remember, used to judge himself by the stock market.
Well, it's obscene. I mean, but that's what he cared about. He I can't believe we're talking about him in the past tense.
He is gone.
I know. He seemed to only care about the about wealthy people and they're in Richmond, despite running on something like Dream.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with that. And the funny thing is, the day he left office, January 20th, the stock market was way up. So, you know, if you could say, well, gee, he loved the stock market, but then he left and the stock market just went way up. It's highly amusing if you care about the stock market and that's how you judge yourself, which is what he did.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And lastly, just on that point, how can, with an increased amount of Americans and, you know, younger people, my generation, are less likely to invest, to participate in the stock market. And I think that increases the stratification of wealth, and also just the fact that, you know, what the economy that my generation experiences is entirely different from the economy of older generations who are more likely to be participating in the stock market. Can you talk about how that divide can be bridged going forward and potentially in a Biden administration?
Well, first of all, again, at the risk of making you angry, but as I said,
I'm not angry. I'm cool as a cucumber.
It is not hard to invest in stocks. You may not have any money, but when I was starting out, when I was your age, and I'm not even going to tell you how long ago that was, you had to have a stockbroker. You normally had to buy at least 100 shares. My wife and I started, we didn't have any money. We didn't inherit anything. But, you know, we got lucky and we found a broker who was helpful. But today, I mean, you could go out and for a relatively small amount of money, you can buy something called an index fund, which did not exist when I was when I was your age, and put maybe $1,000 or $2,000 into the market, you can buy stocks.
Well, I mean, most people our age don't even have, or most, half of American families wouldn't have $500 in an emergency. So
I understand that, but some of them do. I'm saying you can do it modestly. I'm not sitting in judgment of people who don't have money, because I know what it's like not to have money. And it's scary and it's awful. And to have no prospect of money is even scarier. It's frightening. But the Biden people, they've got, I think, a lot of the right ideas. I think from what I understand of their stimulus package, most of it makes a lot of sense. Helping governments makes sense. One of the things they can do, and I would do if I were them, would be I would cut the interest rates on student loans to 1% or something like that. There are a lot of things they can do to help people who are young and struggling and give them a chance to breathe and get ahead. That's what they have to do. I didn't like class warfare under Trump, even though in theory I'm in the winning class, but you don't do that in this country. What Biden said in his inauguration speech, which I hope you listen to, is we all need to listen to each other. We need to try to work together. Let's just try to make this work. Let's be prudent. Let's be decent. Let's listen to each other. And a lot of these problems may solve themselves if we can bring ourselves to do that. And I don't mean you and me. I mean society can bring itself to do it. You know, despite all the hatreds and bigotry and meanness on all sides that now exists, I'm a congenital optimist. I'm 76 years old, but I intend to be around to plague my children for at least another 30, 40, 50 years, you know.
Well, I look forward to that. Okay. Alan Sloan, columnist at The Washington Post, and you've been an economics reporter for a long time, or a business journalist, I should say. So thank you so much for your time. It's great to have your perspective.
My pleasure, Emma. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to rofpodcast.com and support this program by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm. For my daily live stream, we cover all the biggest news stories of the day. We do in-depth interviews, and Emma and I do a little bantering. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
I will light the match this morning, so I won't be alone. Watch as she lies silent, for soon that will be gone. Oh, I will stand, arms outstretched, pretend I'm free.